Today, in part 11 of our series, The Story, we study David in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. David was a man after God's heart. Why? How does David's confrontation with Goliath give us strength? How can we learn to wait upon God from David's dealing with King Saul and David's status as a fugitive? It's God's plan and God's way, always. Here's Pastor Seth.
Human beings so easily judge by externals, by how things seem or how things look. And in the story today of David, we're going to see that God does the exact opposite. He looks at what's going on inside of us and what's going on inside of us that's real, that makes a difference in how we live. Those things matter to God, and that's what we're going to see in the story of David. Thankfully, we finally get to the golden era of Israel. It's taken us a long time to get here, but King Saul is about to die, and David is about to come up and become the king. And there are several things about David that are exciting to speak about. Next week, we're going to talk about the things about David that are not so exciting to speak about. But when I think about David and his story, I think about this. In all of the people in the Bible where we know their story, there is no one I can think of that you can see the wonders of God's work in his life or her life, and at the same time, the propensity to do some of the worst things in life. Both of these things are true about David, as we'll see today and next week. Now, when I think about David, the thing that the scripture points out the most comes from Acts 13:22. This is 1,000 years after the story we're going to look at today, of David. This is Paul on his first missionary journey reminding his Jewish hearers about what we're calling the story of the Old Testament, God's story. And he says about King Saul, when God had removed King Saul, he raised up David to be their king, of whom he testified and said, I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart who will do all my will. Who will do all my will. Now, if you know the story of David, this can be a little confusing because you think about, on one hand, David wrote so many of the Psalms, and so many of those Psalms are like food for the soul in living in this tough life. And yet, you know, we're going to look at Bathsheba and conspiracy to commit murder and the sort of his family just falling into disarray afterwards. So what does it mean when he says, I have found in Jesse, or the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will? What is he saying? He's not saying that this is a perfect fellow, and that every time he's faced with a temptation, he does the right thing, or he's perfectly obedient. He's not saying that. He could not say that about any of us. But what he is saying is that if you're able to look down in his heart, there are some values that drive him that affect, for the most part, how he lives his life. Certainly there are times when he fails to live by those values, but for the most part, you're going to see someone who's driven by some internal values that make a difference that you can see. Now, Samuel is the prophet, and he's given the assignment to go anoint the next king after King Saul is going to die, which is going to take a few years. And he's told to go to a man's house by the name of Jesse. Now, if you were with us a few weeks ago, you remember the story of Ruth. Ruth is a Moabitess, Naomi's daughter-in-law, and she goes back to Bethlehem with her mother-in-law after the famine's over. She marries Boaz, and they have a little boy named Obed. The story of Ruth ends with Grandma Naomi sitting on her porch swing, rocking little Obed. Kind of a neat ending to the story. What she doesn't know is that Obed, that little baby she holds, is going to grow up, and he's going to marry and have a son, and that son is going to be little Jesse, and Jesse's going to grow up, and he's going to get married, and he's going to have 8 sons. This is where Samuel is said, go to that guy's house, Jesse, and you're going to anoint the king. Now, he gives Samuel these instructions. Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature. Don't judge by externals here. Because I have rejected Saul, for the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So he goes to Jesse. He says, Jesse, you have sons. How many sons do you have? And Jesse says, I have 7 grown sons. And he says, go get them. So he lines them up, and he goes one by one. He's looking at each of the sons, each of their succeeding ages, all of them adults. And when he gets to the end, he's just puzzled because he says, I don't sense that any of these sons are going to be anointed king. And he says, do you happen to have another son? And he says, well, I have one, but he's young, and the Hebrew word says is sort of a runt. He's probably 13 or 14 years old. He's out with the sheep, kind of just almost inconsequential. And Samuel says, go get him. And they bring him in, and then verse 12 we pick up. He was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. The Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Now, this is going to be the future king of Israel, David. And so Samuel has his olive oil, and he opens it up and pours it out on his head. And it comes down his forehead and down onto his, and he anoints him the future king. Now, there's a difference between being anointed king and being inaugurated king. It's going to be a number of years before he's inaugurated. King Saul is still alive. But the thing to notice in this part of the story is not when he is anointed or how he's anointed, but why. And the reason he's anointed the future king of Israel is because there's something in his heart that is unique. Hard to find in very many people. Now, if you roll ahead in the Bible to the 1 Chronicles 7, the writer of Chronicles 7 also writes a history of these times from a little bit different slant, more of a more spiritual slant, if you might say. And in 1 Chronicles 17:7, God is speaking. He says, now then tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture. He had been keeping sheep on the day that Samuel shows up. I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep to be ruler over my people, Israel. Now, when I think about this particular story, what strikes me is there are a lot of people I know, and I would hopefully include myself in this, that are generically committed to God. We're generally committed to God. If you were to ask probably most of the people in this room, are you committed to God? You'd say, well, yeah. Yeah. And that would certainly be true. But the question is not really, when it comes right down to it, am I generically committed to God? But as I live my life, am I specifically committed to God? And when I'm tempted, and when I want to cut corners, and when I want to do something in the darkness or by myself that I know I shouldn't do, what goes on there? And that's the place at which what's in our heart or what we value most is what drives our behavior and drives our relationship. Now, probably most people, when they think about David, think about Bathsheba. But the second person that most people think about is Goliath. David and Goliath. David is about between 13 and 15 years old. We're not really sure. And when he's bringing groceries from home to his brothers who are soldiers who are in the battle line, and the situation, the Philistines have invaded, and they're on one side of up on this ridge, tens of thousands of soldiers, and there's a valley between, and the Israel's soldiers are on this ridge here, and they're just looking, having this stare down. And every day, one of the men from the Philistine army who's 9 feet tall, Goliath, think of it, 9 feet tall, comes down out off of that ridge, down into the middle of that valley, and he taunts the soldiers of Israel every day. These are some of the words that he says. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man, have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. The Philistines said, this day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. On hearing this, the Philistines' words, Saul and the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now, on this particular day, this happened 40 days in a row. Still no action. This particular day, David comes with the groceries to give to his brothers who are over here on this side. And he hears and watches Goliath, who's taunting Israel and the God of Israel. And he gets mad about this. And he goes to the king Saul and he says, "Put me in there. I'll do it." Now, Saul looked at him. He's 13, 14, 15 years old. He is not a nine foot tall warrior. But nobody else has volunteered. And so he said, and he doesn't know what else to do. And so he says, "I'll tell you what, come with me." And he takes his armor and puts it on David, hoping that would work. But David's wearing this bulky armor. He's got this heavy sword. And he said, that's not going to work. He said, "Let me just go by myself and fight Goliath." And Saul says, "Well, okay, I guess I'm going to let you go." David gave his credentials. I want you in your handout. "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." Now, I have never fought a lion. I have never fought a bear. I hope never to have that experience. This 13, 14, or 15-year-old shepherd boy had that experience. And in both of those experiences, somehow, we don't know how, somehow, he ended up whipping the lion and the bear. But what he points to is not his skill. He said, "But God got me out of both those situations. And the one that can do that with a lion and the bear, surely he can do that with one who defies the armies of Israel and the God of Israel." So he goes and he gets his armament. His armament are five little stones and a slingshot. Now, this is not a slingshot, but it's the closest thing I have, made by one of the Brady kids in Africa when we were in Kenya about 10 years ago. Handmade out of a tree and out of some, cut the rubber out of a tire, and made a little pocket here at the end. And he was quite a good shot, unlike me. And this is a stone that I took years ago at a camp I went to. He goes running out onto the battle with something like this and five of these. That's it. We pick up the story as the two men, Goliath and the young teenager, are coming together. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." What he sees here is the larger story that's being played, not just the smaller story of the battle. "This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear or even smooth stones that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line. Now, I'm sure he didn't feel like it. He was probably scared to death as far as feelings goes. But he was locked into the larger story. He saw this moment as crucial, and surely God would do the best that he could through David, no matter what the outcome. As the Philistine moved closer, David ran quickly toward the battle line. Reaching into his bag, taking out a stone, he slung it. Struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Imagine that moment. You've got tens of thousands of Philistine soldiers on this ridge cheering on their nine-foot champion. You've got tens of thousands of Israel soldiers quaking in fear that they're about to get overrun. And suddenly the unthinkable happens. Goliath is dead. Now, David, true to his word, runs up to Goliath, takes Goliath's sword, and cuts off his head and holds it up so that there's no mistaking what just happened. And the Israel soldiers suddenly get courage, and they tear down off of that ridge across the valley, and the Philistine soldiers are suddenly the ones quaking in fear. And off they go, and it is a rout and a major victory. David becomes a national hero. And you would think that everybody would be pretty happy about that. Well, almost everybody. In 1 Samuel 18:6, we pick up the story. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul. So there's sort of this victory parade. Everybody's pretty excited about this. And all women are out there singing songs and rejoicing, cheering the troops as they come by. Women came out from all towns to meet King Saul, singing and dancing with joyful songs, with tambourines and lutes. And they're singing, Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And that was true. That's what had happened. However, notice the response of the king. While everybody else was rejoicing, somebody else was furious. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. Why? Because there's something going wrong in his lower story, and he can't see the upper story at all. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? They're going to rise up and they're going to anoint him king. They're going to put him in. What's going to happen to me is what he's thinking. From that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. What's driving him? His lower story, his security, his status, his importance, and it colors everything he sees and drives his character, his decisions, and his attitude. The next day, an evil spirit came from God. Spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall, but David eluded him twice. Now, if you read the story as we have it in 1 Samuel about David, it's very easy to lose sight of sort of the timeline of these events. And it's easy to sort of read them as if they're all kind of squished together within a couple years. But from the time of Goliath, and then the time that he realizes that he's not going to be king, David, until Saul dies, which have no idea how long that will be, and from the time now that he is hated by King Saul, so much that, two attempts are made in his life, and David realizes he has to flee from the palace where Saul had initially invited him to play music. To flee, to be a fugitive on the run, Goliath the fugitive is 13 years. 13 years. He knows in the back of his head he's been anointed king. He's not inaugurated. He's not going to be inaugurated until King Saul dies. Now, imagine you're David. You've been anointed king. You became a national hero by defeating Goliath. The Philistines have left. They're no longer a threat. But now you are a fugitive on the run. All this is 13 years going on. What would you think? What would you think about God's larger story? Are you still here? Hello? Anybody home? What about this king thing? When is this going to happen? Seems like maybe as God has vacated the process. 7 years, 13 years into this, and then we pick up the story as a fugitive. And I'm just going to mention one of these stories. There are two, but just one of them starts in 1 Samuel 24. David has 600 men. He's on the run out in the wilderness, out in the desert. Saul has 3,000 soldiers. They are trying to track him down and do him in for treason. This goes on for years. At one particular moment, David and his 600 men climb up this mountain, and there's a cave up there, a long, dark cave, and the 600 find some shelter in there and hide from Saul. Well, Saul and his army of 3,000 come along, and they're down at the bottom of this mountain, and Saul needs to do some personal business, so to speak, and he sees this cave. And so he walks up to the cave, walks up to the cave in his robe, and he walks over to some little spot just inside, and he takes off his robe to do his personal business. Now, at this point, some of David's trusted soldiers have an idea. They're in the darkness. Saul has no idea that David is that close by. And they give him some ideas. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed with his knife in the darkness towards the robe, cut off a piece of it, went back into the darkness to hide. Saul has no idea what just happened. Saul gets done. He goes and gets his robe. He takes off down the mountain, back to join his men. And when he gets down to the bottom of the mountain, David gets an idea. He walks out of the cave, and he yells down in verse 6. We'll look at verse 5. "Afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe." Seems like such a small thing, doesn't it? Conscience stricken. Why? Because of some values that are working in his heart. That's important to him. To where something what looks so trivial to his men, or maybe to some of us, is a big thing to him. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed." Was Saul a good man? No. Should he have been king? Not from a human point of view. But until he's removed, David says, "That's the guy. And I am not going to mess with that." That's a bad idea. "I'm not going to lift my hand against him, for he is," and he repeats the same value, "he is the anointed of the Lord." He can see God's larger story being told even through somebody like King Saul. With these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. Saul left the cave, went his way down the mountain. Now, he gets down to the bottom of the mountain, and David gets his idea. Verse 8, "David went out of the cave and called out to Saul," down at the bottom of the mountain, which was quite a risk when you're outnumbered 5-1. But he saw an important moment. "My lord the king." And Saul looked behind him. David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say, 'David is bent on harming you'? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you.'" Saul realizes that certainly could have happened, and he would never have known who even did it. "Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lift my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed.' See my father," term of endearment. "Look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of the robe, but did not kill you. Understand and recognize I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between me and you." And what he's telling Saul is, in context for us the last several months, is, Saul, you're living by the wrong story. You're living by the smaller story, and it colors all of your decisions, your attitude, your behavior. And you do not want to be on the wrong side of the story. This is truly a bad idea, as he'll continue. "May the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me. My hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds. So my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us." That should have sent the fear of God through Saul. "May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." Now, what we see in some of these episodes we've looked at this morning is it's not enough just that he has, that David has a generic heart for God. But what you see is this related in some specifics. When he's tempted, when he's going through trials, when life is hard, when he is backed up against the wall, what drives him is, first of all, what's the larger story? And what should my response be in the larger story? Now, as we close here, from the time that he was anointed king, at probably age 15 at the tops, it was 25 years before he became king of the whole land. 25 years. That's a test. That is a long test of character. It's a long test of heart. Is the larger story true? Am I going to keep clipping into the larger story as we go along? Or am I going to say, how long do I have to do this? And jump down to my lower story to protect me and do what feels good now? That is truly a bad idea. Each of you and I have opportunities every week, just about, to help people see something of the larger story as we live our lives. Back in the days when I was a kid, before internet and before cell phones, three men, salesmen, were on a Friday on the East Coast. They'd gotten on a plane in New York, and they were traveling to the West Coast, and they had a change of planes in Kansas City. And the plane that left in New York was late getting off the ground, such that when they were coming to Kansas City, they weren't sure if they were going to make their connecting flight or not. They got off the plane, and they're doing that O.J. Simpson run through the airport, down the concourse, and it's packed with people. They're going in and out of people. And at one point, hoping to get their plane, they're not sure. At one point, one of the guys with his briefcase comes by a little apple stand out there and knocks the apples over, and they just go everywhere. But it's so. But the thing is so crowded. They're in such a hurry to get there. The three guys don't think about it. They get to the gate. They have to still get their check-in. They still have to get their seat assignments. The door's about to close. The first guy gets on. The second guy gets on. The third guy thinks about what happened back with the apples. He is conscience-stricken about this. He tells the guys, I'm going to go back. When you get there, call my wife. Tell her I'm going to take a later flight tonight. He goes back down, takes his briefcase, goes back down. And when he finds the place where the table had been knocked over and the apples, he is horrified to realize that there's a girl who's about 14 years old on her hands and knees groping for the apples. She's blind. And she's trying to figure out, where are these apples? He gets closer and he realizes she's weeping. And she finds an apple and she puts it in her little glass bowl, and she keeps, but there's so many people walking by that it's just useless. And he kneels down next to her and he says, I'm so sorry about what happened. And he picks her up and he puts her on the chair and he says, wait right here and I'm going to get your apples for you. And we'll put them back in and set your table up again. The sobbing slowly abates and he's down picking up apples. And about half of the apples are still pretty good. And about half of the apples are bruised or smashed or stepped on. And they're not any good. And he finally gets all the apples he can see. And he says, he pulls out a $20 bill, which a long time ago meant something. And he said, here's $20 for half of your apples. He said, I'm buying all the apples that are no good. I'm going to go take the rest of the apples to the restroom and wash them. You can still sell them. And so he goes to the restroom, he takes the apple, he brings back, sets it on the table next to her, and she's got her little sign, she's sitting there, and he says, I hope that all this has not been too traumatic for you. He says, I'm going to go catch another plane. She nods her head. He gives her a hug, and just before he pulls his hand away, she grabs his hand, and the blind girl makes eye contact with the man, looks up at him and says, "Are you Jesus?" Every day, you and I have opportunities to live out the larger story. Or we have opportunities just to dive right into our lower stories and try to make it work. That's what we most want. Let's pray together. Father, as we think about David, it's such a challenging, his life is so challenging on all the, for a lot of good reasons. For the most part, his life was driven by the larger story. Even through 25 years of having to wait, day by day, he's asking the question, what would bring pleasure to you? How can I honor you in what I'm doing today and how I'm living? Lord, please protect me from doing something foolish and self-centered. I don't want to be that kind of man. Father, would you give us a heart like David? A heart that values you above valuing even our smaller story. And help us look for opportunities to reflect something of your character in the larger story as you're telling it in our life and through our lives.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.